I want to give a quick thank you again to all of you who listened to The Magic Word, and especially to John Grabiel, who sent a generous donation to our podcast. Thank you, John. Your financial support helps keep The Magic Word on the air, so to speak, and free to all. For those interested in donating, you can send it via PayPal to scottwellsmagic@gmail.com. And for others who might not be able to donate any financial aid at this time, you can always help by leaving a high rating and a comment on iTunes. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and so glad you guys joined us here today. And joining me for this week's podcast is Mr. Carl Hine. Hello. Sorry to say good day, good morning, good afternoon,
I think now.
Whatever it is. Yes, all right. Good to have you then, Carl. We just had Carl in a lecture here last evening for our local group in Houston. He's kind of been touring across the U.S., and you're based out of Florida, though.
That's correct.
And you've always lived in Florida?
I have. West Palm Beach.
Is that right? So you got interested in magic in that area, I guess.
Yes. Well, very young with like a Disney magic book, but then I started going to the magic shop.
Mm-hmm.
I think my first magic trick I bought was actually a Magic Masters. I bought a chop cup and Dominique Duvivier's printing, which is pretty unusual for like a,
for a beginner,
11, 12-year-old. But I ended up finding the local magic shop, Mr. A's Magic Shop in West Palm Beach, Florida, and got the magic book there. Went to a couple Florida State conventions and really got to meet some other sleight of hand guys like Lee Asher and a couple others like Chad Long. And they were the ones that really showed me some really cool sleight of hand, and that's how I got into the sleight of hand magic.
Well, those guys are kind of about your same age, though, aren't they?
Chad's a lot older.
Is he a lot older? Yeah, I guess that's true. Now that I think of it. Yeah, okay.
Lee and I are about the same age. Chad's a little bit older than I am, yeah.
And that's right that Chad's got some gray hair.
So. It's white now, actually.
That's right.
But he's always been one of my favorite magicians, and he's still young at heart.
Well, and you've been good friends, obviously, with him for a while, because I know one of the little moves that you had shared with us last evening, you said was a Chad Long idea.
Yeah.
With a
he's
card move.
He's the first person I saw that did Sybil back in the day, Chris Kenner's Sybil.
Hmm.
And so he's been a big influence.
Why did you decide to get into close-up magic instead of, let's say, illusions or something? I just talked with Kevin Spencer just recently, and, you know, he, from the get-go, was always interested in the big boxes. I mean, that never appealed to you?
Not really, no.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I never really had the dreams of being Copperfield or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I just enjoyed the sleight of hand stuff, and I enjoyed watching and figuring it out. And mm-hmm. It was more of that than it was I respect some illusionists because, you know, to be able to design the illusions and to be able to present them in a way that's fun and entertaining, I think is really actually quite a challenge and a very different set of skill and techniques that very few magicians have. Copperfield, mm-hmm. of course, being one of them that does it really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the vast majority of them, to me, I just don't enjoy watching. I think it's really not the best entertainment. And I think, unfortunately, most of them aren't creating their own illusions. Most of them aren't building their own illusions. I mean, the ones that do create and build and also present, I give the most respect to. And of course, there are some that, you know, they're still just incredible showmen in and of themselves,
mm-hmm.
Even though they're not doing all the back-end stuff. But, you know, part of close-up magic is, again, creating and designing your own illusions and then also performing them. And so the best close-up magicians, in my opinion, too, are the ones that can do all of the whole package.
It's kind of like a comedian who's a stand-up comedian just in front of a microphone. He's just standing there bare before the audience with a microphone separating them. In the same way with close-up, all that you have is a prop as opposed to dancing ladies and music and everything else and the furniture and everything.
Absolutely.
So I can see that from a purist standpoint.
But similarly, too, I mean, you know, you can be a very funny person and go and tell other people's jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And be very funny telling other people's jokes and other people's routines, but it doesn't make you necessarily an artist.
It doesn't make you original by any
means
either.
It doesn't make you original, you know? I mean, I think there is, again, there is worth in just delivery. And so I don't necessarily think there's anything completely wrong with that necessarily, as long as that's in the right context of when you're performing. But, but in general, the ideal goal is to have kind of the whole package.
And with that whole package, you're talking about using sleight of hand, and you're not above using any kind of gimmicks or anything then either.
No, of course not. No, I mean, I kind of incorporate a little bit of both. In fact, I think, you know, using a gimmick at the right time, especially if people are thinking you're using sleight of hand, is actually the best time to use a gimmick, because then they don't expect anything and they're completely blown away.
Right. I think it's the advantage of using a cold deck or something, you know, when mm-hmm. you're switching in something, particularly after that you've used a deck of cards and
had them shuffle it and whatever else, and then you do another trick and then come back and switch in the cold deck that you've already proven your creative magical prowess, and then you can completely blow them away.
And that's one of the things too that, you know, a lot of people, you know, nowadays with the younger kids, a lot of people are doing flourishes and these types of you know, very fancy displays of skill, which, you know, has been around for a long time with fans and spreads and all different types of flourishes. And, you know, there's an old school magic philosophy that you should never mix flourishes and displays of skill with magical moments. And I think that's completely false, because I think that's how you actually create really strong magic in the close-up environment.
Hmm.
And the reason is because if the audience is thinking you're doing something with sleight of hand, and then you ring in a cold deck, or you do a haunted pack with invisible thread, or you use a Svengali deck,
right,
you can destroy magicians and lay people the same way.
Right.
You know, if you think about it as a magician, when you've been fooled really badly, oftentimes it's because you saw someone that you know has incredible skill and they use something really tricky that you weren't expecting them to use. And you thought they were doing something with sleight of hand and they didn't. And that's why it destroyed you. It fried you.
Right.
And the same works for laymen. So I think anytime you mix methods in any magic that you do, you're going to have a more layered deception behind it. And that always makes for a stronger magic in the end. But it doesn't mean that the effect, even though it's layered with multiple methods, doesn't mean it shouldn't be a simple effect to be able to understand.
You know, last evening, in the context of what we're talking about, that you had an effect where that through multiple shuffles and cuts and everything, that at the end that the cards are all back in original deck order, new deck order. And that seems obviously very strong, because it looked like, my goodness, you know, you've cut and shuffled and done this all the way through, kind of like Sam the Bellhop kind of a thing. And along that line, I just talked with Simon Lovell here recently, and he was sharing an insight with me you might find interesting. I certainly did. That he was some years ago with a lady friend, and there was someone who was doing a Sam the Bellhop, and as they were displaying or doing the effect and telling a trick or telling a story and everything, you know, through a multiple cuts and shuffles and continuing to tell the story and everything, that her comment was to Simon that, well, obviously he was getting the cards he wanted, because he would shuffle the cards to the top that he needed. And so he was controlling the cards as opposed to, you know, doing false cuts and everything, you know, and you know, normally as magicians that we think, okay, well, that's creating a situation which that obviously that this is an impromptu thing and you're just happened to calling the telling the story as you see the cards come up. In her case, that as a outsider, a non-magician seeing this, it's that, well, obviously he has these kinds of sleight of hand skills that he can control the cards such that he gets the cards he wants. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it's absolutely. I think you can take a trick like Sam the Bellhop and you can present it in many different ways. I've seen people do it without any false shuffles and cuts and get great reactions just because their ability to tell the story, and it's a funny thing, and it's still amazing just in and of itself that you can do that. In fact, I did a gig the other day, and a gentleman that I was hired to perform for did, not Sam the Bellhop, but a story I never heard of before. Some random layman did this story I never heard of, and, and he did it where he would do it very different. Like, he'd cut the cards, but then he'd go through face up and turn them up, and it was really interesting the way he did it as a layman without the skill that we magicians have, but still make it fun and entertaining, you know? Of course, there's other ways of doing that particular effect that, where it's, you almost really want it to seem like it's completely impromptu. So you have to do a very different type of story structure and the way you present it, of course. And like you said, you know, people can think that, well, that's in a stack and then you're false shuffling, or you can give the illusion that using that same method that you're doing something different.
Yeah.
And I think in general, I mean, there's always exceptions to everything, but I think in general, a big thing that a lot of people don't think about, a lot of magicians don't think about, is what questions are the spectators asking?
You need to look at it from the spectator's point of view.
If you can frame an effect like that, like how is he controlling the cards to get them to come out, they're asking the wrong question. They're asking a question that's not ever going to give them the answer, because that's not what you're doing. You're not controlling the cards to the top of the deck.
Right.
You're actually false shuffling the cards from a preset stack.
Yes.
Okay? So if that's the question they're asking, they're never going to figure that out. And even though that's still a display of skill, it's to the point where it's so amazing that it reaches an element of magic, essentially. Now, I mean, that's kind of getting a little bit deeper when you talk about what is magic. And I don't think anybody is trying to go for, I'm casting spells, right?
Or I mean, have these mystical powers.
Unless you're into bizarre magic or something like that.
Yeah.
The goal is not to necessarily, when we say what's real magic or what's that, you know, what's that moment that you're trying to create, it's not a matter of, you know, some actual mystical supernatural thing. what you're trying to do is create a moment where people don't go, oh, that's a trick. That's a good trick. I don't know how he did it. You're trying to get them to say, there's no way that's possible. That's impossible, even though I know it is.
Yes.
They know that you are doing it using some kind of trickery, and that's what makes it absolutely amazing, because there's no way they can possibly fathom in their mind how that's possible.
Right.
It's the same way when you see some juggler do something that's absolutely incredible. They know it's possible, but they can't fathom the ability to be able to do that.
Right.
And
because they can see it happen.
They can see it happen, right. And that's the odd thing is that that's what makes it amazing. You think it's impossible, and you know, at a certain time, it was impossible for the human to run the 4-minute mile.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right. But once it was broken.
And once it was broken, then it became possible. And that's what we kind of do in a different way than jugglers and other people do it. We find deceptive and trickery to create that illusion of the impossible. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, you know, very rarely, I mean, there's always exceptions, maybe in the world of mental magic, because it's a little bit more believable, that the power of the mind. Mm-hmm. But I think in general, you know, there's that fine line where it's an odd thing that if someone really believed you were doing magic, it would cease to be impressive because now it's part of the real.
Yeah.
By definition, magic isn't real, you know? So it's one of the silliest things you can say is magic isn't real.
Yeah.
Because, obviously it's the opposite of real. It's like saying black isn't white or salt isn't pepper.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And so that's what makes it amazing is that you know it's not real, but you can't figure it out and you have no idea how it works. And so I think that's what you're trying to go for is how is getting people to react in a way that there's no way it's possible. Mm-hmm. And in that situation, what you're talking about with the Sam the Bellhop, I mean, the Sam the Bellhop is more meant to be an entertaining trick. It's not meant to be a magic effect.
Exactly right.
It's meant to be a fun, engaging type of situation.
Right, right, right.
And some people choose to make that about, okay, he's really good at being improvisational and going through it in this type of way.
Right.
Some people choose to make it just be a clever story you're telling with a deck of cards.
Right.
Some people choose to make it look impossible that you're shuffling the cards and the story keeps coming out as you want it to be, mm-hmm. despite all the things that you're doing, that they're cutting the cards, they're mixing the cards. You know, they shuffled them beforehand or whatever other subtleties you built into that to make it seem like the deck was completely shuffled.
Right.
So there's lots of ways you can present that, you know.
Now, one of the reasons I got into this, because I understand that you have a presentation, you didn't discuss that in your lecture, but you have a storyline that is, it's not Sam the Bellhop, but what is it?
Yeah, it's Jack Spade. It's a detective story with a deck of cards like that, yeah.
Okay. A similar kind of a thing. It's just mm-hmm. a different story and a different stack.
Exactly, of course. Yeah, it's a different story, different stack. It's, you know, as opposed to Sam the Bellhop, which has a lot more repetition to it.
Yeah.
This is more of a linear type of story with a lot more puns and things like that.
Okay.
I took from a lot of different stories, including, you know, Simon Lovell has Lily Longlegs, which is a great story routine.
Great story.
You know, Eric Mead's got a great one. There's not King of the Nightclubs. There's a bunch of really cool ones. And yeah, kind of took a little bit from everything and put a little bit of my own into it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I've been doing for a long time. And I've actually created a couple other ones over the years for specific clients and things like that as well.
Have you? That's good to customize.
Yeah, it's good to mm-hmm. do that. But it's a lot of fun. It's a fun routine to do. But the problem with that sort of routine is that you can't perform in most environments. And this is another thing I think is real important. And, you know, a lot of magicians might see Bill Malone perform Sam the Bellhop, for example, at magic conventions, which is a great environment to perform.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. Sam the Bellhop type of routines.
Perfect, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But in the most events, it's not the ideal condition to perform. Unless you're doing a formal close-up show or unless you have a very attentive audience maybe later in an event after everybody's eaten, everything's done, and now everybody's just kind of hanging out afterwards, and now you can do something like that.
But it's not a strolling trick.
It's not a strolling trick, no, because there's no room for interruption. If you get interrupted or all the things that can go wrong completely destroy the rhythm and the story of that effect, you can't necessarily get interrupted by it. Now, I mean, within some degree, you know, that's one of the things that Bill made amazing about the effect is the ability to kind of come in and out with jokes and to play off the audience, which that's a whole different thing.
Right.
But, you know, if all of a sudden a speech starts, even Bill can't really, you know, keep going. Yeah, exactly, through that, you know. So you have to choose the right moment to do that. And similarly, you know, if you're performing and everybody's food comes, you know, you don't want to continue with another 3 minutes of a story while the food's getting cold.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very subjective to the environment you're performing in. So I think that's something always to keep in mind, that when you see a magician in a lecture situation or on DVD or whatever, mm-hmm. do a routine and get great reactions with it, you have to realize that you might not get great reactions because it might not fit your character, your personality.
That's
but
important.
It also might not be appropriate for the environments that you typically perform in.
Yeah.
So being able to recognize that, it's hard for a lot of people, but it's something that's real important, I think.
Well, in the context of the performances that you typically book in a corporate environment, do you book a formal close-up show or normally strolling or stand-up show? I mean, how do you fit that into your performance?
I do a little bit of everything. Most of what I do is cocktail hour, like bar mitzvahs and corporate events.
Right.
As far as strolling magic goes, I do some stand-up shows as well. So I do a lot of parlor type of stand-up shows. So groups of between, 10 to 60, 70 people maybe.
And so would you find this appropriate?
On occasion, I'll do some, larger shows for 100, 200 adults or family audiences, like schools and mixed groups for churches and things like that too. So, I mean, are you saying that is Sam the Bellhop appropriate for that type of stuff?
Correct.
Well, for it depends on the flow of the show too for me and mm-hmm. what the situation is. So I think you can certainly do it for a large group.
Should you script out your show or do you kind of do a little bit of jazz magic as far as
a little bit of both? Yeah, okay. I mean, I have a general structure, but then I also try to go deviate from that a little bit. You can certainly do a Sam the Bellhop type of effect for a large audience. I mean, there's people that have done it on television, or not Sam the Bellhop, build it on television, other versions I've seen done for very large groups that can be played really big and effectively.
Right.
There's no right or wrong way of doing it. But what I'm saying is that, you have to make sure that you adjust it to meet the needs of that venue or the needs of your own personality when you perform.
Right.
And there might be other things that are more appropriate to do, depending upon, all the specifics.
Well, that's kind of what Simon was talking about in his book. Simon says about Lily Longlegs, of saying that here's the general outline, here's my script, and he actually recorded it, and then it was written according to one of the shows. But he said everyone is a little bit different. You have to play off your audience,
of course,
as you said, and basically said, just read through this two or three times, get the idea, and then kind of come up with however that it fits your personality. And I think that's pretty much true of all magic, necessarily. That you can look at the trick, read the description, the pattern, the instructions, throw them away, and fit that into your own personality.
Well, even, I think, especially with that effect, the more impromptu it seems, the more impressive it is.
Oh, exactly.
And even if I think Bill and Doc and Eric Mead, for example, I've done things where they're intentionally screwing each other up and the others are telling the story and just seeing how they can get through. That's a lot of fun if you have the ability to get through and do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's not particularly my talent. I mean, sometimes I'm in the mode where I can really do that really well. Other times I'm not. But even if you're doing it more of a scripted story, giving a little element of improvisation still makes it a lot stronger, because that's what makes it fun. That's the skill that people admire that most people don't have. And so that's what makes it interesting. And I think any magic, similarly, if it seems like it's scripted, it's not as strong as if it seems like it's done on the fly. Because, magic by nature is something that can be done at any time and is kind of random. If you had the powers to do stuff, you do stuff at random times. You wouldn't go through your day every day the same way, doing the same magic effects every single day. So I think the more you can incorporate that into that, and there's exceptions, of course, of fine art where you're doing presentations on stage or music or something like that. That's a different type of presentation. But I think anything that's impromptu or seems impromptu is the best. And it doesn't have to be impromptu. It can be very well rehearsed to seem that way, but you still get better reactions, I find.
You may have defined the difference between craft and art. I've heard magic used interchangeably as a craft of magic or the art of magic. And I think art is something that goes in the direction of the beholder, I guess, and the presenter, that everyone has his or her own way of painting that scene of a waterfall or something. And if you painted one and I painted one, it's going to be completely different. It's just like the magic is being presented, and it has to be something that you're also not necessarily trying to present for the general audience, but it may be more of a specific audience. In other words, I want my painting to hang in this guy's gallery, or that because I think that it fits with, your avant-garde choices of the rest of the types of paintings. So my point is of just trying to craft your art to be specific and customized towards that audience. So you have to leave that room for improvisation, but still have an outline of the direction you want to go, so that you have, again, the ability to kind of go outside the lines if you have to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. But I think, it can vary. There's a lot more room in there for depending upon the person. So, I mean, there's different levels of that. So there's some levels where you might have a routine that is done a certain way, and then, like you said, you can vary from that from time to time. But another level of that is kind of more like jazz magic, where you know all this, what the deck of cards is, like a musical instrument, just like a a jazz band, and that if you know all the basic notes and chords, just like you know all the different moves and slides, yeah. you can go in so many different directions, and you might start one way and go a completely different direction. And oftentimes you'll come up with stuff that you've never done before because right. you're put in situations that you would never plan to be put into, mm-hmm. and now you have to figure out ways of getting out of them or getting into them, and now you come up with completely new ideas. So I think there's extremes of both sides of that, where you can be very structured or you can be very, very loose.
Right.
And it's where you are depends a lot on, where you're going to be on that spectrum depends a lot on who you are and, again, what groups you're performing for. And you talked about art. Like, my mom's an artist, and mm-hmm. just as, in the way I'm an artist, and you and never, mm-hmm. Magicians in general. But I think when it comes to art, there's two, again, extremes. And some people are at either end of the extreme, but most people are somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. And the extremes, are you are doing something solely for yourself.
Okay.
Where a magician at home practicing sleights in front of a mirror.
Right.
Right. There's no audience, no interaction with anybody else other than yourself. And some artists, similarly, some poets have written poetry only for themselves. Only for themselves, but never intending to show it to anybody else. Mm-hmm. Some artists have created art only for themselves, never intending to show it to anybody else. And on the other end of that is the commercial side, where you're creating something only for a specific purpose of somebody else's needs, not for your needs at all, but only for someone else's. Mm-hmm. And, magicians do that oftentimes as well.
Right.
And so most of us are somewhere in between, where we're putting a little bit of ourselves into it. We're doing something that we enjoy doing and that we like to do, but it's also, we keep in mind how someone else, what someone else gets out of that, whether that be a client or
right.
a person, whatever.
Because they're the ones paying us.
They're the one that's paying us.
We're not doing
often.
It just for ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, finding where you are at in that spectrum, and that spectrum will vary for you depending upon, again, who you're performing for. So, a trade show client, for example, you might have to put a lot more customization into making mm-hmm. it specifically for that client than you right. might for a private party, for example. And similarly with an artist, my mom might paint just for herself, but it might have strong commercial appeal because she, what she found in it, or what, a certain poet finds in their poetry, you'll find once it's exposed to a larger audience that more people have those same thoughts.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's a similar type of thing is, you can choose to, typically speaking, I think the more artistic side is the side that you're doing it more for yourself. You're doing something that's more you.
Yeah.
And then it's revealed at some point to the masses, and then whoever is appreciative of that specific,
it's a wonderful thing you find a market
yeah.
of people who like what you do.
Yeah, and sometimes that market's a lot broader,
as
and sometimes
opposed to
it's
try
a lot
to
more
crash
niche.
That towards the, an audience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, some people are really smart in how they can see what a need is and then fulfilling that need.
Right.
And so there isn't a right or wrong. It's just the certain path that you choose to go down.
Right.
And some paths will gain more respect from your peers, and some paths will gain more respect from the masses.
Right.
It all depends upon the path you choose. So yeah. It's not necessarily a right or wrong with it,
And going back to jazz magic, I have to relate a story. When I was at the Magic, working the Magic Island so many years ago, I believe it was Joe DeLion who had done some jazz magic. First time I ever saw this, and this had to be mid-'80s, early-'80s maybe, goodness sakes. And we'd finished the shows. It was between close-up shows and the stage shows, and we were in the Garden of Nefertiti, in the bar area there. And there was it seemed like Scott Hollingsworth and I were sitting there, and there was someone who was a just one of the patrons for the evening. It was sitting at this table, and Joe was there. And I just remember him doing a card, Joe doing a card trick for this person. And it's like, oh, well, really trying to bust him, saying, well, you put it on top, and then he would do something else to, move it around or whatever. And after the third or fourth time of this person, trying to bust him, it seems like they just got towards each other such that instead of him giving up, he just said, well, let me have you do this. No, it's not there, whatever. And kind of dispelling whatever that lady thought. And, she just tried to make it harder and harder. Myself, at the time, I would have thought, okay, I'm going to give up. And it's like, you really don't enjoy magic. You just like puzzles, basically. Yeah. And change the discussion and started talking rather than trying to show him. But no, he continued to go on. And he was fooling her badly and doing different methods. And it was jazz magic at its finest. I thought, that's the first time I'd ever seen that or mm-hmm. started thinking about trying to do something, like that. And it was amazing, at the end that they were, she was entertained and, kind of got her fill of, trying to bust him after a while then too.
And I think when you perform strolling magic, when you're on stage in a stand-up group, it's a kind of a collective audience, and that collective audience can vary from city to city and place to place and group to group.
Yeah.
So you do have to adjust your performance there too. But in close-up, you have lots of different personalities that you interact with on a very personal level.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, and you know, within one group, you might not, you don't really have a collect. You have some form of collective group there in that small group of 5 to 10 people, but there's also very individual personalities that emerge. And, you know, the magic you do, you have to adjust because some people think like magicians. Some people are antagonistic. Some people are very reactive no matter what you do, you know.
And you don't know what you're getting into.
And knowing how to play those different people off of each other and knowing how to do that is, you know, it's a challenge. It's fun. That's what makes it unique for me. That's one of the things I love about doing close-up magic is that you, it's a different challenge every time you perform. Even though you're often doing times doing the same stuff, it gives you that nice sense of consistency and variety that we all kind of need. And so, you know, one of the best things about doing jazz magic is finding that person is very antagonistic and very, you know.
You like to play with them.
And then you play with them and then you're winning that person over. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you don't win them over. But, you know, a lot of time, most of the time I'm able to because I've, you know, figured out how to kind of, you know, to get in and actually do things to make it, make those people A, impressed and B, start to have fun. And that's really what you want to do in the end is make them have a good time. And sometimes they end up being your biggest fans. You know, some of the people that are the least receptive to seeing magic, not necessarily you, but just magic in general, because maybe they had a bad experience in the past. You don't know. I mean, you don't, that's the thing about it. You don't know what their past experiences have been, but giving them a different experience that's fun and positive is a really fun thing to be able to do.
But you have to have that confidence to go up and be able to first of all, have that knowledge to recognize that every group is going to be different and to have the confidence that to know that you can go a different direction. In other words, if you only know, you know, a double lift or you don't know other false, only know one false shuffle or whatever, you could kind of be screwed. So you need to be able to go, if you work in restaurants, strolling, whatever it is, you have to have that depth of knowledge, I guess.
And, you know, sometimes you just get lucky. And sometimes, you know, I remember a time once where I met a friend of a friend that I had hung out with a few times, but never shown magic to him. And, and I could tell he was kind of one of those types of people that was going to be a little bit difficult or whatever. And I would just happen to be at a bar and he wanted me to do some magic. I was like, I'll do some a little bit. And he went to talk to someone else. And I just noticed on the floor there was a credit card. So I picked it up. And I noticed it was his name and it was his credit card. He just drinking a little bit and dropped his credit card on his floor. And so I'll take advantage of this. I had no idea what I was going to do, but I just knew I was going to do something. And, and he comes over. I'm like, sure, I'll do some magic for you. So I did like a, you know, have him pick a card and I loaded his card underneath his beer bottle, and I think it was like a Queen of Hearts, for example, that he had picked. And I asked him to name a card, and the card that he picked, and he said it was the Queen of Diamonds. He lied to me. You can tell pretty intentionally. He's like, he made it up, right? So look, it's over there underneath the beer bottle. And so he picks up, it's the Queen of Hearts. No, it wasn't the Queen of Hearts. It was the Queen of Diamonds.
Yeah.
But I'd already loaded, like, you know, the whole deck underneath.
Yeah, at that point.
So then I was like, well, it's one of those. And he picked it up again. He's like, oh, no, I'm just kidding. It really was the Queen of Hearts. I was just messing with you. And you know, so I did that. I went around and did this like two or three times. The next thing you know, the credit card's underneath his beer bottle. And so, you know, he's trying to lie to me about what his card is. I said, well, is that your card? And you pick it up and it's his credit card. Yeah, he just ran away, you know? And so I didn't know what was gonna, how that was going to go. I just kind of went with the flow. It was fun. But it was just, I mean, he still talks about that to this day because he thought I pickpocketed him on the fly and made his card appear from his wallet into under his beer bottle, you know? And so, you know, that kind of stuff happens when you are jazzing and when you're just kind of not letting it be open to where it goes, and sometimes you get stuck, but that's the fun of it.
Infrequently, we don't take advantage of opportunities that we could or should. Let's say that you're working in a place where that there is a reflective surface, whether it's a butter knife on the table or a window that's in the distance or a mirror that's behind you or something. You know, sometimes I'll draw attention to it and I'll say, you know, show people behind you, you know, and as they hold up the card and I'll say, I'm not going to look in the window or I'm not going to look in the mirror and see that. And then they, for the first time, notice that, you know, then it becomes kind of a funny thing. But if you don't point that out to them and then do some sort of a miracle, you know, then with that,
they're going to think that's what it was.
It's even, well, they will, they might think, go back and recreate that. So I guess there are two ways of looking at that. One is, should you point out the what could be obvious, or should you take advantage of that and then and let them maybe try to connect the dots then later when they go home?
Yeah, it's again, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. That's the problem with it, you know? And there isn't, unfortunately, rules.
Hard and fast.
There are. And that's what I like about it. Is it makes it fun and it makes it entertaining, you know? And sometimes, you know, there's certain routines that you want to try, maybe because it's a new routine, or maybe because it's a specific personality that you know you're going to fool with this particular trick, and you try to force that trick, and it doesn't work because it wasn't the right trick for that environment or whatever it was. And so, I mean, it's hard because, you know, when you have so many things you can do, and the longer you've been in the business, the more you can take advantage of different situations.
Right.
Oftentimes you see a situation that can be taken advantage of, but maybe it's not the right thing to do at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because there is a mirror there, just because there is something there that lends itself to a certain trick, doesn't mean that's the right trick for the time. So you have to kind of play that game with yourself of, should I do this or should I not do this?
And, yeah.
You know, should I proceed more with what I typically do? Or, you know, it's just, it makes it fun though.
Now, you're very creative, and the ideas that you had shared with us at the lecture were not variations on other people's ideas necessarily, but they were a lot of your own ideas and things. Do you come up with those kinds of ideas in performance, saying, you know, what if I did this or that? Or does a revelation come to you at night, or do you...
I think almost all of my ideas are somewhat variations of other people's, and I don't think... There might be lesser known ideas,
yeah,
you know, but I think they're all somewhat degrees. Like,
but are they through research? I mean, reading books or watching DVDs? Or when you say lesser known, how do you
all
find
different.
Those little arcane...
I mean, most of my creativity comes from solving problems. It's not, I'm not like
that you have
a Gate and Bloom
yourself.
Type of creative mind. It's more of a, I start playing with something. Like, so for example, like, you know, Heine 500, for example, is something that, you know, I played with Patrick Page's and Greg Wilson's Heine 500. And from doing it, I just slowly, over the period of a couple of years of performing it for real people, made small changes. And in making those small changes, I eventually realized this is something very different. And then when you start teaching that and you start trying to show people, and then you learn more things about it and you start, again, changing other things. And then eventually it evolves much like evolution into something else.
Right.
And, you know, that's how, you know, that's how it works. Essentially, it starts with one thing and the small minor changes over time, it becomes something completely different.
Yeah.
And sometimes those, even a small difference, I mean, as you know, a pause, a 1 second pause can make the difference between a reaction and no reaction.
Goodness,
it's the same thing with the magic trick. A very small change in a trick, even though it might seem at the surface meaningless, can make a huge difference in the impact and whether I choose to do it or don't choose to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing, whether another magician chooses to do it or doesn't choose to do it.
Right.
And so I think, you know, that's it for that example. That's how that effect kind of evolved, you know. The Heinstein shuffle, for example, and some of the false shuffles I created all came from, when I was a kid, I used a couple different types of shuffles. When I was a kid, when I played cards with my grandparents, and when I became a magician, I became aware of the idea of false shuffles. I was like, well, how do I duplicate this false shuffle? I never shuffled cards like a zero shuffle. That's not how I ever shuffled cards on the table when I grew up. I always did a riffle and a bridge, or I did the overhand shuffle, which my grandfather did. So
you never really used a table. You always did it a stand-up.
Well, we had tables when I played cards, but it wasn't like the shuffle we did was a riffle and bridge. That's the shuffle I did. That was what I was used to doing. I wasn't used to doing
table
shuffles like you would be on a gambling table. It's just not how I grew up playing cards.
Right.
And so that wasn't a readily available shuffle at the time. There wasn't a published fall shuffle that simulated the riffle with the bridge.
Right. Right.
And so I wanted to come up with a way of doing that. And so that's kind of how that developed over time, is figuring out what I knew from here and there and then coming up with something of my own.
Yeah.
And with all those, that's kind of how it's come about.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, like the torn and restored effect, Einstein's dream, that was based upon different versions of that effect, or based upon, you know, ideas from Brent, from Daniel Garcia and Yves de Mergue, from David Williamson, from, you know, Guy Hollingsworth, all these different variations. A little bit of all of those have come into that, and, you know, you have one little breakthrough and you build off of that, you know. So, I mean, they're all all definitely variations of something else to some degree.
I'll give you that, sure.
But, you know, the differences make them that much more entertaining. Oftentimes they're different from what you're used to seeing, you know? And, you know, just like a magician that you see at a gig that knows a little bit of magic, oftentimes those are your best audiences because they know just enough that you can hurt them, you know?
That's right.
It's the same thing with magicians. You know, lectures, you know, a lot of times they know just enough, but they don't know exactly what you're doing, and it seems like something completely new. But it's not necessarily, you know?
Right.
And, you know, so variations of the same plot oftentimes are, you know, a different way of doing a collector's routine isn't that original. It's, you know, sometimes people change small things that aren't really that big of a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, changing a difference, but sometimes those little differences are a huge difference. You know, it's hard, there's a fine line there, you know.
Well, like you were talking about Out of This World, you know, being something that they're, you know, Vernon had done, but then there have been hundreds of variations on it.
Oh, sure. There's hundreds of variations of it. And, you know, the original effect goes back to Paul Curry. That's a super strong effect. You know, the stories of Winston Churchill with Paul Curry are pretty crazy, you know.
Mm.
And it's that effect there today. You know, magicians can show you a version of Out of This World, even though it's a standard effect. Can fry you and make you go, wow, that's something I really want to do.
Wait a minute, let me back up. I'm not familiar with Paul Curry and Winston Churchill. What tied?
Oh, no. From my understanding, like back in the day, Winston Churchill like delayed Parliament in the middle of wartime because he wanted to see the trick like two or three more times to try to figure it out.
Wait, we have a war going on, but I want to see a magic trick.
I want to see this magic trick. Yeah, that's how strong that effect was, you know?
Wow. Okay, this is out of this world.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, that's how strong magic can be. And you go back to Houdan and, you know, wars and killing with magic. I mean, so magic can have really powerful impacts on people, you know.
Oh, wow. Kind of stopped me for a minute while I'm thinking about that. That's kind of interesting. I don't know why I hadn't heard that story before. let me ask then also, as far as like whenever you're creating this, I mean, there's so much information in a lecture that you're giving, but it's really a lot of the technical side of what it is that you're doing. And most lectures do that, but there are a lot of behind the scenes, or I should say, the psychology.
Kind of.
Yeah, it's not, not the how, it's more of the why, exactly, and the psychology and all of that. And there doesn't seem to be really enough time in most lectures there's not enough time in lectures to give that. And I think, B, for the most part, people who are attending lectures really want to see more of the how and not the why necessarily. They're wanting to learn, okay, give me another trick or whatever, you know, and let me have some toys or whatever, you know. I'm not saying it's good or bad. Everybody has a different place in magic. I mean, the house is big with a lot of rooms, you know, in magic. Do you ever do workshops? Do you talk about all these theories and the psychology, or do you ever take expanded time during lectures to discuss that, or only when asked questions about it?
I do some workshops. Lecturing isn't my main business, so it's main business is doing, you know, shows for real people.
Making real money.
Well, I mean, you can make good money doing lectures too if you have the right stuff to sell and do enough lectures. I mean, you can make a really good living doing lectures if you work hard at it, I think. And you know, I know some people that sell magic. They make way more than the vast majority of performers out
Michael
there.
Michael Lamar is a good prime example.
And Mark Mason, Michael Lamar. You know, some guys that have done really well off of, and there's others that are less known, but that do really well off selling magic. Yeah. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
You know? Exactly.
You know, whether for me or not, whether I choose to do this for over a period of time will be decided. I'm enjoying it right now. I'm enjoying traveling, meeting people like you, and seeing the world, and making friends and seeing old friends. So that's the real reason why I'm doing it. Of course, the perfectionist side of me always wants to do it to the best of my ability and be successful at it, and the monetary side as well as the perception side of, you know, being well received. Right. So you always want to improve. And so if I continue to lecture 10 years from now, I would hope that my lecture would be different and better to some degree in some direction than it is now. So I think it's the same no matter who you are, whether you're...
Well, it's constantly evolving. I mean, you look at Aldo Colombini, for an example, of someone who has a different lecture every year. He can come out and people like him and his personality and the things that he's coming up with are easy.
It evolves, too, and you know, and a lot of it has to do with what decisions you make. So, you know, I mean, look at, for example, Daryl Martinez, for example, who's, you know, a great performer and a great magician. And, you know, a lot of his older stuff is a lot more sleight-oriented and technical-oriented. And, and a lot of the card guys, I mean, love the old stuff and kind of hate the new stuff because now he's kind of, you know, become more of making a living off of lecturing, or at least a portion of his income. I don't know all how he makes his living, of course, but and so now he does stuff that's more, you know, tricks that he can sell, and there's nothing wrong with that. And same with like Mark Mason, for example.
Exactly.
You know, the effects that he does, you know, are all great effects that are very commercial, that he knows how to sell them, and it hits that little nerve that makes magicians just want to buy. And I think there's a lot of value to that. Both of them are great demonstrators and salesmen, and so that's I think a great thing to do, but that's how, you know, their business goes, you know. And so similarly with me, it's a matter of I have to obviously sell my stuff as well, but it's more about selling the ideas than it is about specific tricks, and trying to find a balance kind of for everybody, for me. And it's not an easy thing to do, I don't think. It's a constant reevaluation process to try to have a little bit of something for everybody.
Well, there's a lot of
guys. You get the theory in there, you get the simple tricks, you get the complicated tricks.
Right.
But I think in general, for me, most of the stuff that I try to put out there and try to get the perception of, at least, is that it's something that's one step beyond the average magician's level, because we all want to improve, we all want to get better.
Right.
Just because you can't do something immediately doesn't mean you don't want to be able to do something.
Good point.
And so I think that, you know, you have to have something that people can do immediately to get that instant satisfaction, but you also want them something they can aspire to be good at, and something that's kind of so far beyond that they know it's going to take a lot of practice, but that's why you're there.
Sure.
That justifies the reason why you're the one that's lecturing and not them or somebody else in the group, you know?
Yeah.
So I think you kind of have to have a little bit of all that, but the majority of it has to be kind of in the middle, for my style. But again, you know, other lectures, you know, it's about just pushing product and how many products you can get through.
Sometimes it's more like a dealer demo or something. You know,
But there's still value to find in that if you're looking for it, you know.
Yeah. Whenever I'm trying to book lectures, I want to make sure that the lecturer is moving our art or our craft forward rather than just kind of rehash of something that everybody already knows. I mean, I want magicians to become better. My ultimate goal is that by having better performers out there, then more people are going to see better magic, and they're going to want to have magic as an alternate form of entertainment. Mm-hmm. Instead of having a piano player or a DJ or something, that they're going to have a magician because, hey, we saw this guy who's really good. But that person is good because they've had people like Carl Hine who's come through and lectured, and they've learned a few things, you know, or different people that are, who are coming through like that. Right. But if it's been somebody like, I don't know, I'm not going to name names, but somebody who just, had a variation on something that was, very simple, but doesn't move magic forward, then they're going to continue to do the same old stuff. You know, we want people to think outside the box, you know, which is, again, what I'm trying to do, of course, with the Magic Word podcast, is trying to make sure that we have people like you to give creative ideas, and so that way that it might inspire others to think, that's how he does it. You know, I can try this method, mm-hmm. you know, or whatever, and try to improve themselves.
And I think that's, you know, the goal of all that is to try to move forward for yourself as well as the art overall, you know?
Sure, exactly. We were talking last evening about contests and kind of the future, and you were saying that you were thinking you might eventually enter contests. Have you ever been in a magic contest?
Yeah, when I was younger, I competed in one.
But you haven't in a number of years,
I'm sure. It's been a long time, yeah. You know, I've had, you know, contests are... One element of, I think, contests are just... about the worst thing for the art of magic. I think it's not something that
I've heard others say that
is good at all.
You're not alone.
And I think, you know, for many reasons, one being you can't really judge unless you're very specific, unless you can say, okay, who here does the best of this specific thing? It's like, just like saying when someone says, who's the best magician?
Right.
Well, you can't really actively judge who the best magician is until you start getting very specific about it.
Well, unless you have some preliminaries. Let's say like an ice skating, you know, that you have to do figure eights or whatever. Yeah. You have to qualify, basically, in order to be, once you have proven, okay, so what if it happens to be linking rings or cups and balls, you know, that everybody has to be at a certain level to then your next category. Yeah, I think that would be...
Yeah, you could say, you know, what magician has the best cups and balls routine? Now, that's a much easier thing to really be able to qualify and to quantify. Even that's going to be still hard to do.
Still kind
of
subjective.
Still very subjective, mm-hmm. but now you're narrowing it down to a much better degree to really be able to compete and compare. Because, and I think a big problem with competition is that it can vary from year to year, obviously.
Yeah, because it depends upon the judges.
It's also a very specific venue for competition, mm-hmm. Of A, mostly magicians in the crowd, B, not really close-up environments or really not really stage environments oftentimes either for how people really perform in the real stages in the real world.
Good
point. Like even a lot of stage magicians, those acts can't play in most venues that do stage magic.
Yeah.
And so it lends people to create acts at a younger age and times in their life where they're developing, creating it for that. And it doesn't have application outside of the real world.
Yeah.
And now, it doesn't mean that all contests, obviously many of them can be used outside the real world, or parts of it can be.
Yeah.
But a lot of the competition, theme acts and things like that, especially what a lot of young kids are taught and people that are new in the magic are taught, just is a lot of bad magic from a lot of people's perspective.
Yeah.
And especially real performers that work and are actually out there knowing what people like. And a huge, I think, problem that a lot of magicians have is that they don't always get the honest feedback. And even in lectures and competitions, you don't usually get the honest feedback. You don't always see what the judges are deliberating on or what their actual...
Because people don't like to tell people bad news.
People don't like to tell people bad news, especially in the magic world. And it's something that you really need. And more importantly, not only other people, but magicians are really bad at reading their audiences. Mm-hmm. And who's really having a good time? Who's mm-hmm. falling asleep? Who's... Yeah. Being entertained, and how do you try to kind of adjust that, you know? So, for example, on my lecture, I can tell some of the routines I do in my lecture aren't designed for that particular mm-hmm. size of a group or okay. type of sitting.
Yeah.
I do in my lecture because I'm not there to perform. I'm there to perform and teach.
Yeah.
But, you know, so for example, I did a card under box routine, and I saw that you saw me put the card under the box, yeah. right? Now, other people did not see that. But I'm observant enough in my audience to know who in my audience is seeing what I'm doing and who's not seeing what I'm
wow,
doing.
That's perceptive. Okay.
okay? Mm-hmm. And that's an important thing to be able to do.
Yeah.
Now, because I saw that, I use you for another effect later on that did fool you.
Yeah.
right?
Exactly. Yes.
And
yes,
because
yes.
I want to make sure that you're having that experience, and you're not just sitting back going, okay, I know what he's doing all the time.
Yeah.
All right? And I try to do that on all my lectures. I pay attention to who's doing that. And I know now this next trick down that's coming down the road, I'm going to get him with that trick.
Wow.
All right, and that's something I don't necessarily always talk about in my lecture. Sometimes I do. Sometimes it's appropriate. Sometimes it's not. But you have to be aware of that. And
yeah.
so many people are thinking, okay, nobody saw me do that.
Yeah.
Because they were focusing on the one person that was really reacting to it, and right. you did fool.
Yeah.
Right? And you have to be perceptive like that if you're going to get better. Now, again, in other environments, I know I can get away with that almost every single time. Mm-hmm. But in some environments, for certain people that think and that have knowledge and mm-hmm. that know what I'm doing, it's a lot harder to do that.
Right.
But now you have to use different methods to fool those people
right.
and different types of things to entertain those people. So, you know, I think a lot of people, for example, a lot of magicians are don't know when they're killing or not killing, or when they're having a really
they're not paying attention.
They're not paying attention.
Yeah.
They are, mm-hmm. but they don't know what to look for oftentimes, yeah. or they don't aren't honest with themselves. And being an honest judge of yourself is a hard thing, and knowing what your shortcomings are and your strengths are mm-hmm. is hard for a lot of people, and a lot of magicians just don't have that sense of reality.
We said last night, of course, that you're going to be, when you practice these kinds of things, card under box or whatever, or glass, whatever, that you're going to be caught. And same mm-hmm. thing, you know, whenever I've done a watch steal, you know, sometimes you're going to be caught, sometimes you're not. But mm-hmm. you can't be discouraged thinking, oh, this is never going to work, and then quit. You
right.
need to keep working at, okay, why did this I get caught?
Right.
You know.
Well, I think, again, a lot of that comes down to the context you're performing in. Like, if you're in the context of, like, a formal stand-up show, I don't think there's necessarily as much room for that, or in a parlor type of environment. But when you're strolling around, there's a lot more interaction with the audience. So some of what you're doing is presented more as magical effects. Some of it's presented as having fun with the audience. Some of it's presented as just pure trickery or puzzles sometimes even, because that can be a fun thing to do for some certain types of people. And
That's
some people
right.
just love puzzles.
Yeah.
Some people would rather watch you do a card flourish than do an ambitious card.
Yeah.
All right? Yeah. And that's, again, responding to how your audience perceives. So if you throw a little tiny flourish in there and someone actually reacts to that and it's like, oh, that was really, really cool, mm-hmm. you could play off of that. If you know more flourishes, you'll be surprised at how that person will react to that. And to them, that's entertainment. That's having fun. That's being amazed at their own level.
Yeah.
Whereas someone else will have no interest in that at all whatsoever. So if you continue to do that when they don't have the interest in it,
yeah.
you're only fooling yourself. right? And so
yeah.
That's one way you have to really kind of pay attention to your audience, really evolve and interact with them, and then slightly tailor your audience. And that can be difficult when you have three or four different people all who are getting something different out of your performance.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah.
In a close environment, how do you interact and do something for everybody? You know?
Well, this leads to an interesting question. I think, how do you select volunteers? I think it's one of the most difficult things, at least for me, and I think for other magicians as well, when you're doing a stage show, even a close-up show, of being able to select the right volunteer
mm-hmm.
To come on stage who you know will not give you a hard time, or who is not a little bit reticent and they are afraid of the audience or whatever. How do you go about trying to select the right volunteer?
To be honest, I don't have a formula for that. It's just kind of something I do.
Okay.
I mean, and sometimes I get bad volunteers, and sometimes you get great volunteers.
But I think it has to go back to being perceptive, like you were saying.
I think a lot of it has to do with, and for me, just like with intuition, there's obviously some people I'm not going to use for whatever reason that might be,
right.
and some people I'm definitely going to use because mm-hmm. they're super reactive or
right.
whatever that may be. I mean, I think, you know, if you study science, a lot of what we do is subconscious.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a lot of the actions we make, we think we're making them for specific reasons, but in reality, we're making them based upon intuitive things that all the different things are coming in
yes.
in an environment, and we respond to things without actually knowing why we respond to them. And I think some people have ability to be very intuitive and very in tune with that sort of stuff, whereas other people don't. And again, that's kind of going back to what I said before about being realistic about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes some people aren't able to do that, and some people aren't able to really be good judges of character or know how to interact with people. They don't have the people skills. And part of that's just their innate, the way they're born. And some of that has to do with their lack of practice at it.
Right.
And I think you can get better at anything you can choose. I mean, I know some people that are very antisocial, but have some incredible performance characters that really connect with people.
I know exactly what you know? May be talking about.
So, you know, it's possible to do. You just have to decide to do it and constantly be working towards that in a methodical way where your slow changes over time make a big difference, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So with picking character, with picking people, I mean, it's hard because it all depends upon the effect you're trying to do and different things. Unless you give me a specific example, it's hard to really.
Well, like when you're doing a stage show or a stand-up type of a show, you know, a lot of times what I may try to do is, first of all, when you're coming out on stage, people drawing a first impression of whether they like you or not from the way you're dressed before you even, you know, say utter your first word. And then after you give your first few words and whatever, then they draw another conclusion, or that may reinforce whatever idea they had of you then from their initial thought. But I always have something that is going to be, I don't do an audience volunteer type of a thing first. Trick because I want to try to gauge the audience. I want to be able to look out and see who's reacting, who's watching, who's laughing or applauding or whatever. And obviously they're having a good time, and that should be the person that you're going to be selecting. And then from there, it should expand as you start to see other people and how they react.
In general, I think that's a good formula for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do the same, similar type of thing. I don't usually start off with someone from the audience. And, you know, when you're using people from the audience, you can get great. You know, sometimes the audience member makes the trick and upstages you, obviously. Yeah. And other times, sometimes there are such things as bad audiences or bad situations. Yeah. And sometimes it's not you. It is really the audience. And I don't care what anybody says. Sometimes there are bad audiences.
Yeah, that's
true. And, you know, if you've performed at a funeral, you probably know that. I haven't, thank God. But, you know, that's not a good audience for a magic show, you know. And I know magicians have had that experience, you know. So, I mean.
You mean you don't put the fun in funeral?
Yeah, I know, huh? Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think you have to, you know, always be cognizant of that. And I've been in situations where I know and it was a bad situation. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, to my credit, I've done really well at coming back from it and getting out of it. And sometimes I haven't, you know, if you're being honest with yourself, you know.
Yeah, I've heard, you know, one particular guy magician was telling me that he was doing a show in which that before he was introduced, that the fellow who was with the company was talking about somebody else who had just recently died within their company and want to take just a few moments of silence, you know, to remember this person. And now let's bring on the comedy stylings of.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. You know, you got a little hole to dig out of. But talking about bad audiences, that's absolutely true. When I was working the Magic Island, that Scott Hollingsworth, as the entertainment director, you know, is there every night, saw every audience, every show, and he knows whether people have a solid show or not, and that they could deliver a good solid show. And he said, if I have the choice of having someone who is going to be delivering a solid show every time versus those who would have a peak pinnacle performance that people will talk about for the rest of their lives and some shows that it just kind of lay flat, I'd rather have somebody who's solid every show. Mm-hmm. And he said that, for an example, when in my show at the time I was doing, I had a rock in the shoe. And whenever I, you know, dump out the rock, that people reacted. Mm-hmm. And he said that if people did not react to that particular trick, that he said, I knew it was a bad audience. It wasn't you, it was the audience. Because it's such a solid, you know, type of a trick, basically. And so he just recognized that sometimes the audiences are just not going to be as appreciative, you know.
And sometimes it's a small little detail in your timing that you don't realize you did.
Oh,
and sometimes
too.
That throws it off, you know. So I think, you know, in general, I try to get my show so I can try to always be entertaining for everybody. I mean, I try to, that's the challenge, to do that. And, you know, it's very rare that I don't.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes it happens. And sometimes when it does happen, you say, okay, now what could I have done to make that better? Mm-hmm. So even when it is a bad audience, to me, I still put the burden on myself to say, what could I do to make that a better situation?
Sure.
You know? You know, sometimes there just isn't anything you can do. You know?
That's right.
You know? But there's other times, most of the time, you can dig yourself out of it or, you know, make that negative into a positive.
What do you think about using a drunk person? Do you steer away from them or go towards them? I like using a drunk person.
Depends on how drunk they are.
If they're almost falling down drunk, that's one thing, versus someone who's just a little bit inebriated.
Yeah.
I don't certainly make fun of that person, but I think that it's a fun person to kind of mess with because the audience is on your side rather than their side. Say, oh, he shouldn't have chosen that person.
Right.
But then if you treat them with respect and kind of let them kind of fall apart, that I think it's kind of a funny situation. What do you think?
I think, you know, like when you talk about using people, I mean, I guess what you're saying, using a drunk person can kind of go either way. And of course,
yeah.
And even I think making
it's challenging.
I think even making fun of people sometimes isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think
really?
A lot of people think that there's a rule that you should never insult mm-hmm. your spectator or do these yeah. sorts of things to your spectator.
Right.
And I think in general, obviously, you should never be mean to your spectator.
Right.
Mean
or embarrass
them. Yeah. But, you know, a little bit of embarrassment sometimes can be appropriate or the right thing to do in certain environments and certain situations and certain people, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think there's always these rules. And sometimes that's where you get the most funny reactions, the most incredible things.
Yeah.
It's more like you're putting them in the position to embarrass themselves, not so much that you are being mean or embarrassing.
Yeah,
I mean, like
yeah.
there's a fine line with that. But I think that there's – again, the problem is that when you walk those lines, sometimes they go wrong. And sometimes mm-hmm. you put yourself in situations where all of a sudden you realize, okay, this didn't work out, and you set yourself up for failure, which sometimes is the challenge of it, and sometimes it's fun. Most of my magic doesn't deal with that, but I know people that, you know, put themselves in situations like that, that some of the funniest moments I've ever seen is when, you know, I'm
right.
in a close-up environment. I'm saying for myself, more in the close-up environment, I deal with this instead of in front of large groups of people. That's mm-hmm. a whole different type of thing.
Sure.
But even then, it can be a very... It can be very funny situations that can evolve out of that, you know?
Yeah.
And in a close-up environment, sometimes, I mean, I've gone off on people, like, in a fun, entertaining way.
Yeah.
And it's the most entertaining thing that happens, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you have to know the right people to do that with. And it's kind of an art to that, and it's kind of an intuition to that, to knowing...
How far you can go.
And yeah. some people and some personalities can do that, and some people can't.
I think it's a cultural thing also, you know, in the UK, that it seems okay to... kind of make fun of people. I'm thinking of Terry Seabrook, for example, and some others who I have seen who will make certain comments. Somebody comes up and they'll make a joke about their clothing or something, you know, that embarrasses that person, but the whole audience, you know, laughs. You know, here in the U.S., it seems that it's embarrassing that person, and the audience think, ooh, that was a bad thing to say, you know.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you look at like street performers, for example, a lot of street performers, you know, very
they're trying to get attention. They're very
to get their
insulting.
Attention, which has its purpose.
Sure, but, like Gazzo.
Like Gazzo, for example. And I enjoy watching that to some degree and hearing some of that, but I also understand why other magicians, for example, really dislike that kind of style. Mm-hmm. I can see both sides of that for sure, and I think there's valid reasons on both sides of that. One of the things that brings me to mind is Steve Bargatze. Was it you that was talking about Steve, or someone else? Maybe another time where he can similar like Bill, for example, too. Bill Malone can get away with doing a lot of things and saying things that other people can't say that would often be insulting or rude or inappropriate. But for them, it just comes out as being completely funny.
Exactly.
You know? And I know
that's because they developed that character.
Yeah, and I've never seen Steve do shows, but I know he does shows for like high school students and like motivational type of programs in high school. He's talked to me about it a little bit, and I remember one of the things he talked to me that he does is he finds the popular kid and he brings the popular kid up and actually makes fun of the popular kid in front of the whole entire school.
Yeah.
But the purpose he does that is to show the difference between having fun and being funny and being mean
and being a bully
Yeah. And there is a fine line there.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, the reality, there is a fine line. Unless you actually explain that to the kid, it's not just don't ever say don't ever do this, don't ever do this.
Yeah.
There is a fine line where you can do that kind of stuff, and it is fun and it is entertaining. It does no harm. In fact, it's good.
Yeah.
But there's also times that it's really not appropriate, and knowing when that is and when that isn't is a hard thing for some people to get. But until you talk about that and you open that conversation up, you don't always know. You know.
That's true.
And so that's something that kind of brings it to mind. I think that's something that similarly. But again, you know, when you're Gazzo and you're insulting people in the street, I can guarantee you he's had problems where he's pushed it the wrong way. That person doesn't realize it's an act. He doesn't realize it's just having fun, and
it goes
in a very bad direction.
Yeah.
Sean Farquhar told me a story about, and he's one of those people I think that are very much against that style because earlier on in his career he had a situation with a heckler that he said a line and that turned out to be something that you have to hear the story from him some other time.
But I think I have heard the story, and then the audience actually turned against him as well.
The audience, but no, this was something that the guy came over and pretty much burn his house down.
That story.
Yeah.
That was
crazy stuff.
Yes.
But sometimes, when you say something to somebody, you don't know who you're talking to. You don't know who you're picking a fight with.
Yeah.
And sometimes that person is just not right and crazy and will come,
Yeah.
And so, and he now chooses to always take the high road, which I completely understand. And in general, I'm along the line with,
Yeah.
So you really have to kind of know and know what to go.
Good point. I want to go in a completely different direction and back to something we talked about earlier, and that was your Heine 500 that was kind of based on Patrick Page, Flash Cash, and other kinds of things. I was sitting around the table with you and about eight other magicians, and I thought we were in Las Vegas, and I thought it was during the Mindvention that some years ago, and that I pulled out my hundreds, and we started talking about should you change the hundreds back to ones, is what's the reason for that? And the funny thing was, out of the eight of us that were sitting around this table at breakfast or lunch, whatever, that we had that six out of the eight of us pulled that trick out of our pockets. Like, we all carried that. It was like a standard. It's like, well, here's my routine. Let me show you. Here's my routine. It's like, wow, six out of eight magicians, carrying that's such a strong trick and so popular. But I want to have you on record here, kind of your two cents, because it was I wish I would have been recording that as a podcast back then, because we had such an interesting variety of comments of people who performed this all the time. But you talked about this then a little bit last night, and so go ahead.
But I said my luxury beat?
Well, you were saying last night that for those who think that you shouldn't change it back to ones, you said it was just BS.
Oh, just in that specific type of situation. Well, I think, number one, from doing this effect and traveling and showing magicians my version of it, and I don't just have a version, I have many different presentations, which I can only do really one of them when I perform, and I adjust that again depending upon what I feel is right for that particular audience and how I do it. But I think, and the reality is there's times I don't turn the back and there's times I do, and there isn't a right or wrong to it. And as soon as you start saying, why would you ever do this?
Yeah.
Right? Why would you ever have this extreme situation where why would you ever turn hundreds back into ones?
Yeah.
I think, you're setting yourself up for a situation where it's like, well, there's lots of reasons why you might want to turn them back into ones. And so what I said in that lecture essentially is it is total BS, because reality, number one, no one's really claiming to be a real magician to turn $1 bills and the $100 bills.
Right.
All right. But again, it depends on the context you're performing in. So if you're performing, if you're walking up to in a grocery store and you turn $1 bills and you're acting like you don't have hundreds, and you turn them into hundreds and you pay with the hundred, of course you're not going to turn it back into ones. That's the context of the environment.
Right. You need the money to pay.
I give the example, if you're David Blaine on television, you're not going to walk up to a bum on the street, turn ones into hundreds, change them back and say, ha, 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 I can do this, you can't.
Yeah.
You're going to give it away. That's the context that particular situation involves. So, I think that it depends. And so what I was saying, my lecture was that essentially that, if you're working a private party or a corporate event, if you're working under the construct of, I'm a real magician, I can turn $1 bills into $100 bills, well, your reasoning is flawed and completely unrealistic to begin with, because why would you be at this party performing? It makes no sense at all. Why would you be at this trade show or bar mitzvah or corporate event or birthday party, whatever it is, doing magic if you could turn $1 bills into $100 bills? That makes even less sense than not turning them back into ones.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
As you said, you're going to walk around with a sack of bills.
Yeah, unless you're, A, you're walking around giving them away because you're benevolent, or you have a stack of $100 bills in your pocket that's, a couple really thick because you've been doing it the whole night.
Right.
Then that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Right. Because you're just like, well, money doesn't mean anything to me. I'm just here having a good time with you guys, and I'm making money. I'm doing it. I can make money at home, or I can make money here and show you guys,
Right.
So, there are, again, there's reasons why you wouldn't turn them back into ones, And I know people that, charge the clients extra to give the money out, So that's one way you can do it. Uh-huh. For me, it's just a matter of turning the presentation. And for my particular presentation that I came up with, I think it's very clean and it's very magical. It's very pure. It's very hard for the lay audience, because there's so many different things going on. Even though this effect is very simple, I turn ones into hundreds, there's lots of technique, multiple layers of technique that's hiding what's going on. Mm-hmm. Because of that, and because I've eliminated that, they don't think I can switch the bills. I don't think I can I'm using special bills. I don't think I'm doing all the things that they might think. I'm eliminating all those things in their mind. So the second time I do the change, I turn them back into ones, it's always stronger. I always
because they're
a stronger
really burning
reaction.
Your hands. They're watching.
Because
so
the first time they think, okay, maybe he did that, I didn't see it.
Right.
Maybe he switched them, I didn't see. He had to have switched them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He had to. It was amazing. It was really good.
Because magic doesn't exist.
It doesn't
exist.
It has
to be a trick.
It has to be.
Yeah.
And now you do it again and you repeat it. Now there's no way. They just can't do it. Now you can see them running away. They can see them screaming louder. and that's the reason why, for that particular effect, because the method is strong enough, the method can be repeated, And in fact, I'm using a slightly different change. I'm not doing the exact same thing. I think not because I think the method is transparent, but because I think it gives a little bit of variety. You don't want to do the exact same thing mm-hmm. again, just because it makes it almost mechanical. Like that's how the trick has to be done.
Sure.
If you're doing it a second, slightly different change, the second on the way back, it makes it seem more organic to me. And I think that's a big part of it. And so, I mean, I just don't think there aren't too many rules in any art form that can't be broken by someone that knows what they're doing and
yeah.
puts the thought and the why behind it, you know?
Right. Well, obviously you spend a lot of time not just thinking about the construction of the presentation for mm-hmm. that, but also the changing to and from. Yeah. You know, I'd forgotten about that when you mentioned sometimes that a company will pay you to give out the bills. And I did that once. I had forgotten that in the context, it was like a Christmas banquet party, and they said, look, we want to be giving out some money to
right.
you know certain individuals. So I said, I got the perfect idea. And so I called these people up. But the thing was, once that I changed these ones into hundreds, I said, here, keep it. You know, I didn't want them to think it was for me. So that right. was something I had. So this, you know, although this looks like it's for me, you know, that they had given yeah. me the ones to change, you know, so this is compliments of this mm-hmm. company, you know, for a job well done or whatever you did this year, yeah. you know. There is always a way of keeping them
that way. And it's just a subtle difference in how you present that to make that fit into the context of what you're doing, but still right. have that work, you know.
Right, right.
Because it would make the company look back if you turned it back into a one.
Exactly right. Yeah, you did a pretty good job, but then you really fell down, you know, and that you cost us some money, so you get just the one. Thanks, yeah. you know. You lose so
bad. And, you know, similarly, like we've talked about too, like, you know, if you can't afford to use hundreds, you know, there's many different presentations you can come up with that would use fives, tens, $2 bills, twenties, or paper to money, or whatever it
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
There's many different ways you can do it that make complete sense. Ones to hundreds is not really the only way of doing that. It's just a matter of how you present it and what you're doing, whether you're hypnotizing somebody or
sure.
you're telling a story from your childhood and that fits
oh
the story you're telling or sure. whatever it is. There's so many different ways you can present that trick. And that's the great thing about like that effect, you know, and so many other effects in magic that there's so many different variations of and presentations of because
yeah.
it really allows you to put your personality into it and you know, do it the way that you enjoy doing it.
That's
you
right.
to do it.
Well, to kind of wrap up over here, that again, something we talked briefly about then last evening, that your future as to kind of what your thoughts are. You're thinking about not sure if you're going to be wanting to compete or continue to do more lectures or to maybe just do corporate things or, you know, kind of where do you see yourself 5 years from now, 10 years?
I don't know 100%. I mean, a lot of that has to do with where I end up. If I end up staying in South Florida or I move somewhere else or what I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, competition thing is just kind of a small blip on that
yeah,
radar,
right,
you know?
Exactly.
But
whereas some people actually see that as a stepping stone that they have actually gone on to, let's say Michael Dardant or Alex Ramon, certain people who have won certain things or Jason Andrews that
yeah.
have gone
well,
on.
I think a lot of people say that, you know, competition doesn't really do a lot for you. And I think if you're looking to do stuff in the magic world and to
Lance
some degree,
Burton.
Even outside the magic world, you know,
yeah.
I mean, like Lance Burton, for example, I mean, there's a lot of people, a lot of magicians I know that have made great connections because the reality is in the magic world, there are a lot of wealthy benefactors that love magic and that
sure.
and that's one way they can see people and if you compete and you win, it's one of those things that people can say, oh well, this guy's
yeah.
the best,
yeah,
you know?
Exactly,
yeah, even though it's obviously
best.
Not true, you know, no competition winner is really the best in the world at that time, of course, but
yeah.
You know, so anybody that's winning, I wouldn't think you should think that, you know, in general, but it's just, you know, it's just something that, you know, I think I read an essay once by someone, it might have been McBride or someone, I don't remember who it was exactly, but I've heard a couple of people, I think a lot of it, the thing about like a competition act is it gives you a focus to be able to really try new things and to try to challenge yourself to do
mm-hmm.
something. And it's kind of, that's a good challenge and fun thing to do. But the problem with that is, do you do it something that you would do in the real world and that you would actually perform for real people, or do you make it just for the competition?
Right.
And that's kind of the thing. Do I really want to put my time into something that's really just for competition?
Just for competition, yeah.
And, you know, it's like, do I have the time to do that? Because, you know, I'm staying pretty busy performing and stuff, and it's mm-hmm. hard to practice that kind of act in the real world, unfortunately.
Yeah. Right, right, right.
And so it's a hard thing to do. And, you know, but there's also people, magicians I know of that have won, Steve Agassi, for example, just doing what he normally does.
Yeah, sure.
You know, so there's exceptions to all that. I don't know. And even if I give you an answer right now, I know it could change. So
sure.
there's lots of different ways, and it'll be interesting to see where I am 10 years from now. Yeah, and just like as with anybody.
Sure. Well, okay. Well, then in conclusion, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast, and my question I always ask my guests are, what are your magic words, or what is your magic word? It could be something that you use on stage. It could be something that is your life motto, you know, something that you live by, something that's important to you, something that, that means something to you, that you, you know what I'm saying?
My magic word.
In or one word. It could be a phrase. It could be a couple of words or a phrase or a sentence. Or
and the one word that's always kind of stood out to me is balance. I've always like thought,
wow,
trying to find balance.
That one
in
I've
life
not heard.
Is always a fun thing to try to do, I always try to pursue that in my life, and not always successful at it at all times. But
try to keep your personal and your professional.
Between personal and professional, between, you know. And everything, I think, in general, from my own standpoint, I think the answer is typically some sort of gray in the middle. And I think that's no matter what you're doing, you know, trying to find that right balance of things to get the maximum reaction. If you're talking about, like, you know, performing an effect or and anything in life. So I think it's just kind of a fun thing. And I understand some people don't agree with that, but I think in general, I think it's a really good thing. That's just kind of the way that I try to, in general, live my life.
I love that. Finding the balance.
Yep.
That may be a good title for this podcast, Finding the Balance. Very good. Well, thank you very much. My guest today has been Carl Hine. I thank you, Carl, very much for being with us. And for the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out.